yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes are gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Today, we have a guest. We want to talk about independent politics, independent political action. As you know, on this show, I've been railing from time to time about what I consider the two corporate wings, Democratic Party and the Republican Party, two wings of the corporate party of America. You know, my way of characterizing their records in terms of policy is the Republicans wreck the economy in the process of making their wealthy corporations, investors, and 1% households rich. Then the Democrats come in and they only partly resolve the issue and in the process make the same people even richer. This is neoliberalism. This is the policy mix, the arrangement that's existed at least since the late 1970s. You know, the Democratic Party, this is not the Democratic Party of your grandpa. No, this is something different. You know, in the crisis of the 1970s, what happened was the Republicans were even more taken over by corporate elites. They got active. They formed the Business Council, the Business Roundtable. CEOs began functioning more politically. You know, there are surveys that show that CEOs spend over half of their time political lobbying. Yeah, they're lobbyists. They're the biggest lobbyists. And the corporate America, the Republicans, the CEOs, formed this alliance with the religious right and the right wing and developed new ways of mobilizing, controlling the media. You know, the beginning of the talking heads, right-wing talking heads shows on radio, then TV, and then cable. And they put Ronald Reagan in the office, and he implemented their policies. But they weren't satisfied with that. What they then did was take over the Democratic Party in the late 1980s as well. You know, the Democrats thought that, Reagan was a temporary phenomenon. Now, but they soon lost control of their own party because the money bags took over the Democratic Party. And Bill Clinton was their boy. You know, the Democratic Leadership Conference, the DLC, this was the corporate wing of the Democratic Party. And they took it over. And they eventually disbanded because they had control of the party. And they still have control of that party. The money bags still rule that party. Just look at what they did in the last election. Prevented Bernie Sanders, and Sanders still thinks he can reform that party. And they're still slapping him in the face, right and left, every time he makes an effort. It can't be reformed. What we need is independent political action at the grassroots. And we have a guest today that represents that movement successfully. The oil town, oil refinery town in California, Richmond, where the Richmond Political Alliance, the RPA, successfully took over local government. And now, correctly, I believe, are making initiatives to expand not only to other municipalities, but to the state level. One of the leaders of that movement is Gail McLaughlin, and we have Gail as our guest here. And I believe Gail has announced that she's running for lieutenant governor in California. So we really want to know a little bit about how it was done. Because if we're going to have an effective independent political movement in this country, it's going to have to come from the grassroots. It's going to have to come from real people, not from intellectuals saying, oh, let's have a convention and declare a new party. You know, the academics and intellectuals blowing smoke. That's not how it's going to happen. It's going to happen with real people, real movements from the bottom up. And it's a molecular process, and it's beginning here. And Gail and the RPA are at the front of that. It's happening elsewhere. Maybe Gail will tell us a little bit about what's happening in other localities in California and so forth. The process is beginning. It's going to take a while. But it's the only way out. It's the only way out, because it'll just be more of the same. Tweedledum, Tweedledee, let's shift the Democrats for the Republicans, and we go through the same process. And over the last 30 years, real wages and benefits and conditions have deteriorated step by step. They sent our jobs offshore. They gave us part-time temp gig jobs, took away our benefits, privatized everything. Privatized our schools, privatized our pensions, privatized our health care. We all got to pay more for everything, and we're getting no wage increases, real wage increases. The top 10% of the workforce is doing okay, but the bottom 80% is going nowhere or going backwards. We talked about that last week, right? We talked about labor on Labor Day and the conditions of jobs and benefits and wages and all the rest. Pretty dismal. Well, we got to work our way out of this, and the only way is from below, with real people and real movements coming together. And we got to stop this identity politics nonsense. It's a big distraction. It's got to be part. I'm not saying, you know, anti-racism should not be part of the whole new movement. Yes, it should. It's an important part. And feminism and all, you know, ecology and all the rest, but we better start focusing on real money issues for real people, because that's how you're going to organize and mobilize the biggest number of people against the two wings of the corporate party of America. There's just no other way out. You see, the Democrats love to continue talking about identity politics because it's a big distraction. They don't have to focus on how they're failing on jobs and wages and benefits and all the rest. It's a big distraction. Well, I think the American people are tired of the distraction. On the left and the right, there's a rebellion going on against all that and a return to real hard economic issues. And that's where it should belong, because that's the only way you're going to mobilize the biggest number and most effectively. And it's going to have to start from below and locally. But then the local efforts have to coalesce. They have to come together. And real people, real movements like Gail, at some point will have to call a statewide convention of the movements and form a new party. Not yet. We're not there yet. We got to do a lot of hard organizing at the local level. And I'm really pleased to have Gail on, because she's going to tell us how they did it, how they're doing it, and how they will continue to do it. Gail, you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you so much, Jack, for having me on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. You're for real. We like for real people
right.
on the show, rather than journalists and intellectual talking heads spouting about stuff they don't really know. All right, that's the real media, okay?
Yes.
Gail, tell us about the RPA. Why is it? What is it? Why was it formed? And what has it accomplished? And then we're going to talk about your campaign for lieutenant governor in California. But, you know, give us some background first.
Sure, yes. I am delighted to talk about the Richmond Progressive Alliance. I'm a co-founder of the RPA, as we call ourselves. And I'm also the first corporate-free member of the council in Richmond. And the RPA endorsed me and all my campaigns, of course. And I served two terms as mayor and until I termed out, and served about 3.5 years as a council member. So all these campaigns I ran and won without any corporate money. And that's what the RPA is all about. It's an inclusive, diverse, progressive, corporate-free, year-round organization. And we came together in 2003, you know, regardless of party affiliation. We came together based on our progressive values. And we came together to be the leaders that we were waiting for. It was clear that our city was, our city council, for years going back before the RPA was in the hands of Chevron. We have this major Chevron oil refinery in our city, and the entire city council was either purchased or intimidated by the oil giant. We also, you know, were known as a high crime city and a city with a lot of poverty without anything being done to move in the right direction. So we formed the RPA to build local political power and run corporate-free candidates for local office. And, you know, like I said, I was the first corporate-free council member, and that since then we've made lots of gains, and we also have other corporate-free council members. So as of November 2016, we have won 5 corporate-free council seats, all RPA members out of 7. So that's a supermajority of the city council that are RPA members and were won their campaigns without any corporate money. And so that's one of our biggest accomplishments. But we have made so many others. You know, over the course of the 12 and a half years that I was in office, we increased the local minimum wage to $15 an hour. It's going to be going up to that in a little over a year. We also passed the first rent control, just cause for eviction law in California in 30 years. This was the first rent control law in 30 years. We did this in November as well. We also defeated Chevron's money in our local elections. They spent millions to try and defeat us. In 2014, they spent $3.5 million to try and defeat me and 2 other RPA progressives. And we all won, and all the Chevron candidates lost. And we've done things like reduce crime 75%. Well, our homicide rate went down 75%. And crime as a whole was reduced dramatically. And defend immigrant rights. We defended our city's sanctuary status. We got more taxes from Chevron, $114 million in additional taxes in 15 years. We are filing suit against Chevron for that major fire that I know people in the Bay Area remember in 2012. So, we made sure that the city understood that this can't ever happen again, and we have to do something strong and take Chevron to court. So we've done that. We're in the process of that lawsuit. We also are a member of a community choice aggregation program so that 85% of our residents and business, small business owners, get their electricity from cleaner, greener, and cheaper sources of energy. So these are just a few things. Of course, we defend our public schools. We work on the homelessness issue, push back on the expansion of prisons, and so many other things. So I'm very proud of what we've done in Richmond, and I was glad to be a part of it. But it was all done by, you know, working with the community, going door to door, going to community events, and that people power, that building consciousness collectively to showcase that, you know, we're serious. We're serious about taking our destiny into our own hands. So that's what we did on a local level and so much more. And at a certain point, people started asking us, you know, how did you do it? And so we've been sharing the RPA model to many cities. And that, of course, led to my recent venture and recent campaign. So I'll stop there and see what else you have to ask.
Well, what is this RPA model that you share? I mean, I'm sure we have a lot of listeners here who, would like to replicate the successes of the RPA at their local level. How did you start out? What were the first steps, and what would you say the model is?
Right. Yeah, thanks for asking. So, yeah, like I mentioned, people started asking us, and I started, and others also from the RPA, but I was giving a lot of presentations to other cities who were asking how we did it. What is this model, as you're saying? And we tell them, you know, we came together as a small group because we were fed up with things not changing. You know, we were all activists in the community, as there are throughout communities in California and throughout the country. And we said to ourselves, you know, we need people in behind that dais. We need people sitting in those decision-making seats, because as activists, even though we do great work and, you know, we have to keep doing that great work, they're not listening to us. You know, we'll speak before the public forum or at the public podium, and the council members and the mayor at the time would listen and then say thank you for your comments and then vote, you know, in a way that wasn't moving the city forward and, you know, very much in the corporate status quo line of thinking. So we felt if we had people behind that dais sitting in those seats, we could take our own destiny into our own hands. And so after we came together and formed a small group and decided to run candidates without corporate money, that was our rule from the beginning, we started holding our own forums, you know, and introducing our candidates. And, you know, hearing from the community, what are your issues? And, you know, we knew what we stood for, but we also knew that sometimes the community had issues that we hadn't thought about and we had have to embrace and, you know, give a response to. So we held a people's convention. This is all in 2004, which was the year of my first campaign. We held two forums. The first forum was simply called A Dialogue on Richmond. And we heard from the community. I introduced myself. Andre Soto was another candidate. He introduced himself. And it really got the ball rolling. And then, of course, we started calling people, bringing organizations together, making it clear that, hey, it's time for us to come together and you know, share our values. And we held marches. We, of course, knocked on doors that, you know, really made it clear that a new political a new type of politics was in town or was, you know, stirring up the status quo here in town. And people responded. You know, I was at all the community events, passing out literature, and we made it clear that this is more than just getting elected officials into office. It was about empowering people because, you know, I've always saw my role as an elected official as a reciprocity relationship. I stand with the community, and I respond to their needs and their ideas and, you know, share my ideas, of course, as well. But, you know, there's a whole, I think we have like 12 steps that we put out, and it's on our RPA website, RichmondProgressiveAlliance.net. If you go under history, there's a brochure that's called Sharing Our Experience. And it basically tells people, you know, a little more in detail how they can do what we did. And one thing that's clear, we got to say no corporate money from the beginning because we have to make it clear that you can't serve both the people and the corporations. And so I remember when I first started talking about that, people's eyes opened wide in Richmond. They said, you know, you don't take corporate money. This is, you know, they're used to people, their candidates or candidates that they had to choose from all being funded by Chevron. So it takes time. And over the years, we got more council members. We built our movement. It's also our work is a local movement building effort. We grew the movement. We held educationals. We have people. We encourage them to come to council meetings, share their input. We hold rallies in Civic Center. And we've done just incredible policy changes because of this local movement building with, you know, really true progressives sitting on the council.
Well, it sounds like you applied a combination of direct action tactics and electoral. You know, too often we see one or the other. People protest and march and this and that and so forth, and they let off steam when there's an issue, and then it dissipates. You know, the marches and the protests and so forth are all essential to show people that, hey, you know, you're not alone. There's a lot of us have the same feeling about what's wrong. But then you got to translate it somehow into some sort of ongoing political power and influence. And you know, that's where elections come in, I think, to some extent. And it sounds like the RPA has applied both elements. That's really, I think, an important point for people who listen, who tend to do one or the other to the exclusion of the other, which is leads you to a dead end, pretty much, I'd say.
What were
some of the initial concerns when you called these early meetings? You know, your group, and you went to the community, you called these early meetings, have people come to the forums and whatever and express their concern. What were some of the things that you were surprised to hear were important to the citizens of your city?
Well, actually, in 2004, which was the first campaign year, the city was in a massive deficit, a $35 million deficit. So people's concerns were very much around services being cut, community centers closing, library hours being, you know, cut back, and, you know, the unions. We work very close with the unions, the SEIU especially, to really hear their issues. And, of course, the union was rightfully upset because hundreds of employees were being laid off because of this deficit. So what we heard from people were, hey, keep our community centers open, keep our libraries open, fix our streets, get the money, find out where that money went, and, you know, find out new sources of revenue generation. And so we came up with some really important ideas, like closing Chevron's tax loopholes, that they had a special tax loophole, and they still do, actually, for their utility users tax, although we got a settlement of that $114 million, which was partially because of the utility users tax loophole that they were allowed to have. You know, people were very, very concerned that the city didn't have as many staff members, and, you know, staff members were, of course, upset because they themselves couldn't provide for their family as they are now, as they were then, on layoff. So we made it clear that, I made it clear through my campaign and the RPA, through all our campaigns, that we want all those union workers hired back. Crime, of course, was a big concern, and we talked a lot about how we have to address the root causes of violence. And what had been talked about in the past was more police, more police, more police, and that doesn't solve the problem. You can't stamp out crime. You know, you get more and more crime coming forward, people who are desperate, young people don't see an opportunity in their lives. They, you know, unfortunately, often, you know, go into lifestyles that cause them to do some violence. And so we made it clear that we wanted to put forward outreach teams to, you know, quell the violence before it occurs. And we put forward a wonderful program called the Office of Neighborhood Safety, which is made up of formerly incarcerated individuals who have turned their lives around and reach out to the young people in our neighborhoods and cause them to get to the kind of services they need and you know, the kind of help they need so that they can have opportunities in their lives. I think that crime and the cutting of services were probably the big things, and how going to get, you know, this is obviously bad management on previous city council's part due to the we had this $35 million deficit. Well, the community wanted to find out how it happened and to make sure that it doesn't happen again and to bring forward the kind of revenue we need to bring our city spiraling upward rather than spiraling downward.
What were the services that you were able to restore? I mean, this Office of Neighborhood Safety seems like a pretty important thing. You know, a lot of the cities, you know, there's this combination of cuts in services and desperation, and people out of desperation turning to crime and so forth. They're mm-hmm. directly related to each other. So what services were you able to restore once you your organization, RPA, had control of the city council? What mm-hmm. services did you initially focus on restoring, I guess is the better question.
Right. Well, let me clarify first. It's been over a decade of work. I mean, I was a minority on the city council until this past November, and I should also state that I resigned from the city council as of this a little over a month ago because of wanting to focus on my lieutenant governor campaign. However, the point that we got to was this supermajority on the city council. That occurred as of this past November. But if you go back to 2003 when the RPA first started, you can see there was, over a decade of work. And most of that time when I served as a city council member and as mayor, I was in the minority. But I had the community with me, and the RPA was building community and was building coalitions. And, you know, I, as an elected official, and the other elected officials, as they came forward in the RPA, we got another RPAer in 2006, or I guess it was 2008, and then in 2010. And so little by little, each election, I had some company on the council in terms of my RPA colleagues. But, like I said, we were a minority for most of the time. And so the accomplishments that we made were hand-in-hand with the community. We, the elected officials of the RPA, were also organizers. We think that's important. And so together with the RPA, we called for reopening the libraries, reopening community centers. We did this from the dais, every chance we had as a council member and as mayor. I said, we need to make sure that these services are there for our community. And then, of course, you had people coming to the public podium saying the same thing, and that put pressure on the those non-progressive members of the council. So they not only heard from those of us sitting at the dais, but they heard from the community. And that makes the difference because, of course, it's people power putting that pressure on those corporate-controlled elected officials that finally causes them to break and say, all right, I better go along or else I'm not going to be reelected. And so we pushed that continuously. And the services that we offered for our young people in particular to really guide them on the right path so they didn't end up in crime lifestyles were things like job training. We had a very well-known and nationally renowned green job training program. We also have services like recreation. We made sure that our community centers were renovated, our parks were renovated, and that opportunities were there so that the young people, after school would be able to have everything from arts to science programs to athletic programs. So these were ways that we really engaged our youth and put our money in the right place. Instead of putting the money into, pushing for luxury developments, which is what the previous council did, we started saying, we need truly affordable housing, of course, and we need to shift the priorities to providing the opportunities, whether it's the parks or the community centers or the libraries, or we actually gave $3 million to our school district so that our neighborhood school would stay open. So a lot was youth-focused, but also we, of course, wanted to keep our safe, and we engaged the community and neighborhood watch groups. We built a community involved police force, hired a reformed police chief who shifted the culture in the police force. So all this took a lot of work, and it didn't happen all at once. And so people shouldn't be discouraged if they're building a progressive alliance, and they get up one person on the council, then maybe another one, and if they see that things aren't moving in a way that in at the level of speed that they would like them to happen, they should know that they just have to never give up. And that's what we did. And we supported each other. It's so important to support in solidarity your colleagues, your fellow activists, and keep going. Even when there's down times, even when there's defeats, you still win if you have that solidarity and you keep moving forward.
Well, it sounds to me like, and I think it's an important point, that you don't necessarily have to have an immediate majority of local government institutions to have a significant impact, because those non-RPA members or members of your council there were obviously pressured and influenced to go along with your policies if they wanted to extend their stay in office. I think that's important, that the idea you don't have to take everything over immediately, but it's a process, and even during the process, when you don't have a majority, you can have significant political influence. And I think the other important point is that clearly once your members got on the council, you maintained your relationships with the community, and you used the community mobilization to put pressure on those who otherwise probably would have gone after their own political careers and taken even more money from Chevron. And we know that process. That's the Democratic Party process, right?
Right. And one thing that that the RPA is clear on, too, is that it's year-round. And I think that's a mistake that some organizations, they form and, support a candidate or something, and then the candidate gets in or doesn't get in, and the organization, just falls apart or no longer feels that it's needed. But year in and year round, you need to have community empowerment, civic involvement. The elected officials of the RPA, the progressive movement, need the support of the community, and the community needs to be engaged with the elected officials on issues that are up, on the diets and such. So it really, year in and year out, never give up. That's always been, our policy.
There's always a tendency in local politics where some people, ride the coattails of a movement and organization, and then kind of jump ship and they look after their own careers first and foremost to go to the next level. It seems to me like you've got some sort of ongoing organizational continuity that's extremely important to prevent defections, I guess we might call them, from the movement to the other side when they want to go higher and they got to, now I'm going to take corporate money because I want to go higher. Can you describe your organizational, how you've maintained organizational coherence and continuity, which seems to be important,
Mm-hmm. Yes. So, it's clear that we know that there are forces in the city or there, in every city that would like to co-opt a progressive movement as it develops. So we were very clear on that. Some of us had been activists for decades, and we knew that having an independent movement, an independent progressive alliance, was very important. Others would say, hey, join us, or, we've been around longer in the city, and the RPA is a new organization, when it was a new organization. And we were clear that, some organizations were around longer, but they were obviously not making the change that was needed. So we were very clear in our independence. And we also understood that conflicts occur in every organization, and conflict is a good thing, you know, and as long as you democratically work through the process of hearing different views, you know, RPA members don't always agree on everything, and we go through the process and majority rules, and that's how we operated. And you know, for the most part, we have come to terms on almost all the issues that the RPA, now the RPA doesn't take a stand on every issue of the city, but on the big issues, and we've come, you know, we've been very clear on issues like corporate, no corporate donations. That's a given. That's in our bylaws. No elected official will take corporate money. The RPA doesn't take corporate money as an organization. Smaller issues we may disagree on, and elected officials of the RPA may disagree on. But I think even when there are disagreements at RPA meetings, we handle them pretty with civility and with respect for one another. And from there, we take a vote, and democracy always rules. So that's really important. But maintaining your independence and making sure democracy rules, and keep growing the organization, because you have to, you know, the whole idea is to bring people as a whole into our democracy, as you know, as cities, as states, as a country. If we don't have people engaged in our democracy, you know, we're really not fulfilling the mission of what democracy is all about, and that's people joining together to define our collective destiny.
You mentioned bylaws. Is the RPA a dues-paying organization? You have an organizational structure that you've described, and bylaws, you know, indicating you know, some basic rules and actions of the organization. You know, one of my big complaints is that organization structure is important. Because how you set up your organization will determine what your strategy might be. And, of course, your strategy will then dictate your tactics. But it seems to me that there's not enough attention given to organizational structure and strategy. We know with a lot of young folks today protesting legitimately against, you know, Urban Shield and anti-immigrant statuses and so forth is all very important. But you've got to have a structure. And even in the labor movement, I have a book I'm working on about how the union movement needs today to radically change its organizational structure, because it was based upon conditions and a movement that no longer exists. In that, in the history of organized labor, unions have always radically changed their structure during periods of crisis in order to resurrect and go forward. And I believe that the current union structure is terribly outmoded and ineffective, and it's conducive to business unionism and co-optation. And it needs to be radically changed. Well, you know, that's just my view here, and I'll be talking about this more with my union friends here. But tell us, you know, what did you as an organization in the movement decide that your structure and your bylaws and dues needed to be in order to be effective?
Well, you know, we had bylaws that we developed at the very beginning of the RPA, and over the course of years, we've modified them a number of times. I think we it clear we wanted to make sure we had a democratic operation. So I think at first we tried to have consensus be the rule for how we operated. And at a certain point, it became clear that, you know, sometimes you don't have consensus. There are certain issues and that you need to have consensus on, or at least like 80%. I think endorsements of candidates, there's a high percentage that our bylaws say have to support an endorsement. But for other issues, a simple majority is what is, you know, required. And so over time, we've made various changes, and we've also made changes in the structure, and I agree with you, structure is very important. It became clear to us we wanted younger people, we wanted more people of color. We always were a diverse organization, but we wanted to really further diversify, so we made some real proactive outreach into the community, other activist groups and activist individuals that we trusted and wanted to see get closer to us. And so I think it was 2015 that we did a big outreach into the community and brought in more people of color, more young people, so that today we have a 28-person steering committee, I think it is, in the RPA, and it's a majority people of color and a majority women. We also have, quite a few young people, I think, a lot of younger people and some very young people, like in their 20s, and we want to keep moving that effort forward. And so we also wanted action teams. So all this is in the bylaws in our most recent revision of them as of a few years back, and, making it clear that we wanted to have a steering committee and an elected steering committee, and also have action teams so that people can participate in an active way. Like we have an education action team, we have a housing action team, we have an outreach team. Like I'm on the outreach team, that's why I give these presentations to people, sharing some of the stuff we're talking about right now, but also sharing some of the stuff about my campaign, which dovetails with all of this. And, of course, you mentioned dues. At first, we weren't a membership organization. We later became one. We think it's important to have not only a steering committee, but, hundreds and hundreds of people and growing in the membership. So we charge $12 a year. It's a very modest fee. And, of course, if somebody couldn't even pay that $12, we would waive that. But, we think we have to pay the rent. At first, we did not have an office. We operated out of people's homes. Later, we got an office, and we now operate out of an office right across from Civic Center. And, we have volunteers. It's a volunteer organization. People staff the office on their own free time. And it's been quite an evolution. And these action teams meet and then report back to the membership and report to the steering committee. And it's turned out to just be a really dynamic and exciting organization.
And listeners can read this on RichmondProgressiveAlliance.net, your website, if they want to see about structure and what you do.
Absolutely,
so
absolutely.
Let's turn to your campaign. I understand that now you are attempting to take this whole movement one step further. I'm sure, and if we had time, we'd talk about it more, how the RPA reached out and helped develop other like municipal city level movements, but I'd like to talk about another step, and that's apparently you've thrown your hat in the ring for a lieutenant governor. I think this is very important to move to a higher level, both for visibility and promoting your principles and your programs and so forth. But eventually these movements have to move from local to state level, and given the decrepitude and the inability at national level, even the two wings of the corporate party of America can't seem to communicate. They're fighting with each other. Nothing's getting done at that level. Politics is moving to the local and state level, and expanding to the state level politics of the RPA, I think, is extremely important. Tell us why you've thrown your hat in the ring, and what you hope to achieve by running for a lieutenant governor.
Right. Oh, thank you so much, Jack. That's my new venture, and it's essentially an organizing campaign because, my experience in the RPA is really what led me to want to expand upon what we've done at the local level. So what we, you know, once we started giving presentations to other cities and communities, when people were saying, how did you get to where you are right now in Richmond, we started thinking, you know, we could spread our message further. We'd have a larger stage, a louder megaphone for talking about this building of local political power, this building from the grassroots that I know you mentioned when you started out your show today. So I decided I would take on this race for Lieutenant Governor of California, a corporate-free race, the only corporate-free candidate for Lieutenant Governor that I believe has ever run a race, and hopefully will be the only corporate-free Lieutenant Governor in California that wins a race. But the purpose is to, first and foremost, encourage people to build alliances like the RPA and run corporate-free candidates for local office. And they are popping up all over the place. You know, there's already a San Diego, a Pinole, there's a South Bay, there's a North Coast Progressive Alliance, and others. And so I'm sharing the message of how people have to build themselves from their own community and their own issues, their own base, their own grassroots movement. And then my focus as Lieutenant Governor will, of course, be to support these alliances and to help network them together so we have that statewide power to affect the policies that need to be put into place on a statewide level. Because we know as much as the local power building is essential, there are some issues that have to be dealt with on a statewide level. So I'm talking through my campaign about things like single-payer Medicare for All, Free College California, of course, reforming Prop 13, closing that corporate loophole, stopping fracking, banning fracking. I'm talking about an oil severance tax. We're the only major oil-producing state in the nation that doesn't have a tax on extraction. And I want to see that tax money go to making, you know, solarizing the whole state of California. Also, a progressive millionaire's tax. I think cities should get aid for sustainable development, and we should be a sanctuary state, you know, and put forward all kinds of affordable housing incentives, and of course, our public schools. We have to stop the privatization of our public schools and stop the privatization of jails, of prisons, and defend unions. And lastly, I mean, there's many other things I talk about, but another really important thing is a public bank, a state public bank is something that I think will benefit our state. So I talk about these issues as I go city by city, in addition to encouraging the organizing work on a local level. And people are really, really excited because these are the issues that they themselves know we need as a community to, as a statewide community to really move into the kind of really democratic, affordable, healthy California that we know we can be if we all put our efforts together. And
yes,
one more
and,
thing.
It's almost essential to move to the state level because what you do at the local level can be thwarted easily by the two wings of the corporate party of America at the state house. I mean, we can see that you know, with efforts to pass minimum wages on a citywide level, often checked by you know, politicians of the two wings of the corporate party at the state level. We see it in California with rent control, where cities wanting to impose reasonable rent control are prevented from doing so in California because of legislation that pretty much exempts all apartments that were constructed in recent decades from any kind of rent control. So, you know, when you start getting effective at the local level, the corporate interests move to the state level to try to negate and reverse what the gains at the local level. So you almost have to move to the state level if you want to continue what you try to achieve at the local level. So,
right.
And a good
example of that is, for example, when you think about healthcare, if we don't get corporations out of our state as well as out of our city governments, we're going to have a corporate-controlled state officials that do things like Speaker Rendon did and shelve SB 562, the single-payer Medicare for All bill. And, he got contributions from the insurance companies and pharmaceuticals and that's what he does. That's what happens when corporations control elected officials. They may talk the talk, but when the bills come before them, they say, oh, the time isn't right now. We'll just set it aside for now. And it isn't even getting discussed. It isn't even put on the floor for discussion. So it's really important that we tackle these statewide issues and also that we bring up the point, the very important point, that corporations need to be denounced for involved in our state government. So that's something that I'm also committed to doing. And again, with the community, that's the way we get things done. That's the only way we're going to get things done because people need to be educated. People need to know, and many people are, but many, many more need to be that it's the corporations that are causing these problems and not getting the interests of the people met and moved forward through the government bodies. And until we get those corporations out of government, we're going to be continuing to have this problem. And people are the voters, right? And they're going to vote. They need to vote for the people that understand people are people and corporations are not, and we have to stand with the people. So that's what drives me. What drives me day in and day out is to build this solidarity, brothers and sisters among our communities, among our statewide, residency, and until we can show a California of a different nature, and hopefully others in the country, other states will take notice, and they too will start building from the grassroots and getting corporations out of their states, and we could overcome this catastrophic free fall that we have in our country with this whatever you want to call them, clown in the White House, but very dangerous clown in the White House. So this is what it's all about.
Where can folks interested in supporting your campaign go in order to, join it in terms of maybe providing some people power,
Okay.
I'm sure you're going to try to reach out to other communities and so forth. And, there's nothing wrong with making contributions.
Right.
One by one, person by person, as you say, corporate contributions to campaigns are a no-no, but the fact of life is that it costs money to run campaigns, so that people should go ahead and if they can't personally participate, which is the preferred way, at least help fund your campaign to what extent they can, even a dollar here, $5 there. I'm sure it's all... So welcome.
Yeah.
Where can they go? Tell the listeners where can they go to make a contribution or say, hey, I want to help. What can I do for you?
Yes, people can go to gayleforcalifornia.org. That's G-A-Y-L-E, four is F-O-R, and California, the whole word spelled out, .org. And they can sign up and get updates on my campaign at the website. And if they go to gayleforcalifornia.org/donate, they could make a donation. And, all levels of donations are welcome and appreciated. I'm reaching out, I should say, to a lot of the Our Revolution Bernie Sanders groups, and people have started giving me the $27 donation that they gave Bernie. And so $27 donations are welcome, less, more. It's something that all helps build this grassroots campaign. So I welcome people to give what they can and, of course, volunteer and stay updated. It's something that gives me hope when we come together.
Yeah, let me just add to that. You know, folks are complaining about the situation. There's certainly a lot to complain about. You know, should get off their butts and do something. It's time to do something. The situation is just getting worse and worse, if you haven't noticed, for the last couple decades. And it's not about to get any better. And I personally don't think the Democrats are going to do all that well in 2018 because they're still in their swamp of identity politics and can't really get the real message that it's economic issues that people are most concerned about now. And, you know, it's only going to get worse, and it's going to be a big shocker after the midterms in 2018, I think. So it's time really now to build independent politics and new movements and new organizations. As you pointed out, it doesn't occur overnight. You got to put in the legwork. And you know, you can't give up. There will be defeats. There will be steps backwards. But there's no alternative, you know. And if you keep sitting on your butt and just complaining and belly aching, things are just going to get worse. And, you know, even if you're older, 50, 60, 70, you know, what about your kids and grandkids, you know? I mean, do it for them. Do it for them.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely, and it can be fun as well. Organizing can be fun. It's hard work, and we should not shrink from the hard work. But you know, there's no greater joy in my eyes, in my sensibilities, than really being in solidarity. You know, building bonds with your fellow human beings. You know, in our own interest. There is a real soulful joyfulness in that. So it's a lot of fun. So activate, and, you know, of course, my campaign would welcome you as a volunteer.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing worse than sitting around isolated and hopeless. The only way to overcome that isolation is to get active with others, and then you'll see that, the world isn't hopeless. There's a lot of people, good people, trying to do something. And,
right.
You know, first step, at least contribute, and second to your campaign, and second step. I mean, I've contributed, I'm going to contribute again, and whatever time I have personally, you know, in between writing books and running radio shows,
right,
I'll be glad to put my shoe leather to work helping you out too, Gail. So I'm putting my money where my mouth is.
Thank
you out Jeff. There listening, time to do the same. Time to do the same. Time is running out. You know,
thank you for
it can get worse.
Call.
If you think Donald Trump is the worst, it can get worse. So you better start doing something.
That's true. It's going to take us all. And
right.
Time is running out for democracy.
Right.
That's
so locally, for those who may be listening in Northern California, are there any public events or fundraisers or something going on that they might contact
yes.
you to come to and, you know,
yes,
in person?
If they, yeah, absolutely. There is a fundraiser that is happening on Sunday, and it's happening at Steve Early's house. Steve Early is a RPA member and Richmond resident, and he is holding a fundraiser at his house. And we actually have David Zuckerman, who is the independent lieutenant governor from Vermont, who is in town and will be at this fundraiser for me, and I'm so excited to be meeting him. And so people could come to this fundraiser, and I will give you the address here. Let me see here. So the address, it's from 2 to 5 on Sunday, September 10th, 747 Lobos Avenue in Richmond. It's the home of Steve Early and Suzanne Gordon. So I'd love to see whoever can make it come and join the fun.
Is that Lobos as in wolf?
Yes, L-O-B.
Logos.
Yeah, L-O-B.
E-O-S, wolves. Okay.
L-O-B-O-S.
L-O-B-O-S, 747
Correct.
Lobo Street. Okay, those of you local, drop on by. And those of you who want who aren't local want to find more about this Gayle, G-A-Y-L, for California.org.
/donate.
Right, and check out the Richmond Progressive Alliance.net website as well. Well, thank you, Gayle. We really appreciate your coming on and giving so much valuable information about independent political action. Okay,
thank
this
you,
is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.